Good morning. This is Wednesday, November 27th. It's a little after 8 a.m. And this is the Wednesday edition of the morning show. We're here live at 88.5 KRFY. And thanks for tuning in this windy, windy morning. We were off the air a little bit this morning, but our hero, Jack Peterson, came down to the station and rebooted our system. And we thank him for that. So, and I'm Susie Prez, and I'm here with Chris Bessler, my co-host. Hi, Chris.
Good morning, Susie. How are you doing today?
I'm doing fine. I'm wide awake, and that wind, for some reason, really gets me woke up.
It's almost like a cup of coffee, right?
Yeah. It's a good thing, because I've had no coffee.
Yeah, it's really quite windy out there. I can report that the electricity went out of Baldy about just a little after 7, I think, today. And there was a tree down on Baldy. There's probably some trees down around. I'm sure there's some power outages. So,
I heard Old Town and Hope are both have minimal outages. Mm-hmm. But, yep, there you go. We made it. Here we are. Yes. And what do we have planned today?
Well, this morning we're talking with our state senator for District 1 Legislature, Jim Woodward. Jim, thank you for being here.
Good morning. Thank you.
Yeah. And we're going to dive into what's coming up. The 2020 legislative session begins January 6th, and we want to hear what you anticipate might be coming up that's going to be of interest to our local folks here. So, and we're going to get back to that in just a moment.
So you probably want to hear about the weather from the National Weather Service.
Yeah, is this wind going to keep going?
Well, it says currently 32 degrees. Right now the wind speed is coming from the north-northeast. Really? 32 miles per hour, gusting to 45. And the wind chill right now is 17 degrees out. This wind now until 12 a.m. Thursday, high wind warning. So that's it. Does that mean midnight?
That's midnight tonight.
Yeah. Okay, so that's what we're expecting. Slight chance of snow, about 20% chance today and tonight. Then Thursday, Thanksgiving Day. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone. Mostly sunny with a high of 29 and diminishing winds. Winds 8 to 11 miles per hour on Thanksgiving, gusting as high as 28, but no snow in the forecast after our 20% today and tonight.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like a kind of a blustery sort of forecast there. I'll mention a few other things going on outside. Sunrise this morning was at 7:09 a.m. It'll set tonight at 3:57 p.m. That means over the course of the last week, with the days getting shorter, we've lost 16 minutes of daylight per day. The good news is that in only a few weeks, we're going to be at our shortest day of the year. And that's December 21st, winter solstice. And then every day will be getting longer.
I sometimes think that's my favorite day of the year because we do start going back towards the more sunny days or more light in a day in the daytime. It's just kind of a nice moment to move forward and to be grateful.
Yeah, longer days. There's a new moon on Tuesday. If you look up in the sky and we get some clear skies like we might have tomorrow, as you mentioned, Venus is super bright up there. So that's the brightest star in the sky, or not actually a star, a heavenly body. Look up, check that out. The night skies here, we have long nights. Looking up into the stars is really pretty fascinating here in the wintertime. I will mention the lake level is down to a little over 2051 feet now, and it should be where it holds at the winter pool level. They dropped it about 0.3 of a foot last week, so hopefully that's about it.
Okay, and I just want to mention a couple things, then I'd like to hear the Sandpoint City Minute from you, Chris, but why don't we hear that first, and then I have two announcements, and then we'll get to our interview.
All right. Sandpoint City Minute, submitted to us from Jennifer Stapleton, the city administrator. You may have noticed, I'm going to throw this in before we start that we're fence-free downtown on First Avenue now. The streets are looking really great. They're not done, of course. They still have to come back and do sidewalks, but the sidewalks have all been backfilled with gravel for the year. You can roam around First Avenue, come down and check it out, because our merchants here in the downtown had a pretty tough go there for a couple months during construction while the fencing was up. And here's the city minute. City crews have completed phase two of the downtown holiday lighting plan this year, and everybody's invited to come down and check out downtown all lit up beginning tonight. In addition to the downtown core, lighting has been extended along Sand Creek. City offices will be closed for Thanksgiving holiday Thursday and Friday, but city crews from all divisions are on standby to respond to impacts of the windstorm. So they're staying on top of that.
Well, that sounds good. And a couple other announcements. On Friday at noon, I will be here in the studio live with the Shook Twins, who are back in town, our very own Shook Twins. And so you can tune in at noon on Friday, and we'll be talking with them, seeing how their life is on the road and what's been up with them. They come back every Thanksgiving for a Give Thanks special Panada concert. And this year they have John Craigie and Holly McGarry with her band Honeysuckle. So it's a real homecoming for a whole bunch of people. And so tune in Friday at noon for that live interview with them.
Yeah. Are there still tickets available? Do you know?
You know, I think there are, but they're getting very close to sold out. They're also playing up. So the Panada on Saturday, Bonner's Ferry at the Pearl on Friday night. So if you can't get tickets at the Panada, you could try Bonner's Ferry too.
I have heard, I'm not sure it's actually accurate, but that the locations around town are sold out. But if you go to the shooktwins.com website, there are still some available online. Mention also that we, KRFY, are having our annual meeting and fundraiser. That's in a few weeks, Wednesday, December 18th. It's 5 to 8 p.m. at the Poor Authority right there at 203 Cedar Street. There'll be music by Marty Perrin and Doug Bond. We'll have, what will we have at this event, Susie?
Well, a lot of fun. We're going to have of course, they have the raffles where you can get all kinds of interesting things. But the biggest thing is you're coming to show support for your community radio station right here at 88.5 KRFY. We're also going to have some really cool silent auction items and the music. And because it's our annual meeting, I'll also get up and do a little report. We'll have an annual report in writing, and I'll get up and give you the state of the station, so to speak.
Yeah, and we're a 501c3 nonprofit organization, so we like to report back to our members and supporters in the community, and this is our way to do that, and throw in some fun and some tasty beer as well. So hopefully everybody will come for that. I want to mention two other things that are going around town. We would be neglectful not to mention, on Friday, it's the annual Christmas tree lighting and Santa's arrival at Jeff Jones Town Square. So enjoy Turkey Day tomorrow, but then be sure to come for that. That kicks off at 5 p.m. with performances by carolers and dancers. And then there's the tree lighting, and then Santa rolls up. I think he usually comes courtesy of the Sandpoint Fire Department. So that's a great, great event for kids. And they've been getting several hundred people for this event in the last several years. So it's a lot of fun.
And that's Friday at what time?
That's Friday at 5 p.m. at the town square. And then skiers will want to know that Schweitzer is going to open on Friday. They've been making snow up there. They'll have just the midway run open. But if you got a hankering to go skiing, that's going to start on Friday as well. And, of course, there's a lot of other things going on. Check out our calendars on krfy.org, provided by sandpointonline.com. You can see them there as well.
And we appreciate that from Sandpoint Online. Well, let's get to our interview. And again, welcome, Senator Jim Woodward. It's always nice to have you here bringing us information about what's going on in Boise and really how it relates to the importance of what's going on here in North Idaho District 1. Senator, you completed your first year of a two-year term in the Idaho legislature as our District 1 senator and are about to start the 2020 legislative session that starts January 6th. It typically goes through March. And I think the session starts with a State of the State speech by the Governor Little.
Yeah. Yes, that's correct.
Okay. So thanks for coming in. It's, like I said, always a pleasure. But so you mentioned that the session will start with a review of all the Idaho administrative rules. 7,500 pages. This sounds like a big task. What is involved and why a review of all the rules instead of just the new rules this year?
Thanks, Susie. Just a little bit of a refresher on the rules and law. With every year the legislature writes law, and we have law in place from existing. And so when a new law is put in place, then to provide the details for implementation of law, the executive branch then writes rules. And those rules go into effect as temporary proposed during when the legislature's not in session. And then the following year, the legislature comes back and reviews those rules. And that's not necessarily not all states have rule review. We're I think one of 37, but not all states have that. And it takes different shapes. And in our current rules review, the rules come back from the agencies, and then either the House or the Senate can approve that set of rules. And one body may not want to approve those, but the other can. And that's the way we're set up right now, that one body can approve them. And that's where we came to a standstill last year. There, some folks would like to require that both bodies approve the rules. And that was proposed as a piece of legislation last year. And so as a result, there was disagreement between the House and the Senate. And we're normally at the end of the session, a piece of legislation is passed which repromulgates all of the existing rules. This, we've had 8,000 pages, and all of those rules then are repromulgated, and they were not repromulgated last year. That forced the executive branch under Governor Little to go through and put forth all those rules, all of the existing, what we've had in place for some time, as temporary and proposed rules. Now they fall in that category of temporary and proposed, and they're coming back. The great thing was it was like an opportunity for spring cleaning, and that's why we're talking about 7,500 pages versus 8,000 pages. When you have that much on the books, sometimes you don't look at a rule that was put in place in 1922.
Yeah, a long time ago, yeah.
Or some
it may no longer even be relevant.
That's right. And so there's been the rules have been cleaned up. IDAPA, the Idaho Administrative Procedures Act, and those rules have been cleaned up. But now we do have to go back and look at all of them per our law to put those
in
place.
Long will that process take, do you think?
Well, a couple ways to approach that, going back through every rule individually or taking a whole package of rules, and that's going to be up to the committee chairman. We know that as a committee chair in either the House or Senate, you have some say over the process in your committee, and so most likely we will see large groups of rules that are the non-controversial rules that will then get promulgated all in one bill and go to the and go forward. But there's a potential to open up some conversations we've had before that were not always agreed upon. We have some rules in place and education standards. And I was trying to think of a few other examples there that maybe immunization standards.
That might be more contentious.
And they'll get opened up again.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So the session is going to start that way. And it could take a while. But then... So then you move on to the whole session and what happens?
So there's always proposed legislation. Typically, in a typical year, there are about 900 pieces of legislation that have come forth. And in the result, out of the meat grinder, at the end, maybe 300 new laws can come out. And some of those are just
a year, each and every year.
Per year.
It's kind of scary sounding, isn't it?
Well, a lot of times they're cleanup.
Yeah,
because you might have to write a piece of legislation simply to change a word that, or just changing a number, so anything to reflect the conditions today. Oftentimes, legislation gets written with hard numbers instead of something that grows with the economy, or so you have to come back and revisit where we are on legislation like that, and so. There are oftentimes just small changes that need to be made, but they still come forth. But 900 pieces of legislation, it's a lot to go through.
Mm-hmm.
As a member of the legislature, I don't even necessarily read all 900, because if it doesn't make it out of committee, if a piece of legislation is proposed in the House or in the Senate and it doesn't make it out of that committee, then I probably won't even take a look at it, because it's time management. And so we have a process for... A draft bill in the committee. If it makes it out of committee, it goes to the floor of that body. And then from that, if it passes on the floor, then it goes to the other body, but goes to the committee there. And then from that committee to the floor. So we see it in four different spots. And so I would only see it, if it started in the House, I would see it after it had been voted on three times, and I would be in on that floor vote. the fourth time.
So the committees are where a lot of action really happens.
Definitely. That's exactly right. That's where public input happens. There's no public input on the floor. That's a vote with the members. But the committees have a lot of public input down. And it's unfortunate for us. We have such, maybe not unfortunate, but we have a large state. And so people who are close to the Capitol participate in that process heavily. The school superintendent will run down to the Capitol and testify. If it's a 10-minute drive or an hour drive, that's a little bit different than our perspective on it. And Boise is a long ways away, and it's kind of just something that, if you haven't been there, and it can be intimidating. We do have some chances now. There's still a pilot program, but we have some remote testimony in committees now.
That you can do via the internet or video, right?
Mm-hmm. And right now, just set up, for example, at NIC, has been the pilot program where you can go to NIC and then tie in with a video and audio.
And I will say the state's been really good about posting a lot of stuff on its website.
I agree, Chris. That website, that legislature.idaho.gov, has a mass of information. You can follow the budget process, the legislative process. Can see everything there. Figure out who your legislators are, all the email addresses, bios for the people, but all of the state code, all the rules in IDAPA. There's a wealth of information on that legislature.idaho.gov.
Can you see which committees are looking at what issues at what a certain time, so you can put input? Because if you can't get down there and testify during a committee session, you could at least talk to the people, send messages, emails, and letters to the folks that are on that committee, especially if it's your representative.
Yes, you can. So you can see all the meeting agendas and the daily schedules. There's a standard meeting schedule for all of the committees. I'm on the Senate Finance, and so we meet. I'm on Finance, which meets jointly with the House Appropriations Committee, and we meet every day at 7 a.m. for the budget process. I also serve on the Education Committee, and we meet Monday through Thursday at 3 p.m. But all of those schedules are on the website, and you can see what that agenda, not only the standard schedule, but also what the agenda is for every day. And there's live streaming available legislative website, a link to public television, and you can watch committee hearings and watch the floor. And so it's all very accessible now, much more so than it has been in the past.
Mm-hmm. So you're on finance and education committees. Our other representatives here, Sage, Dixon, and Heather Scott, they sit on different committees as well. Do you think we're pretty well represented in these committees since so much action happens there?
I do think so. In fact, that leadership makes up those committees, and leadership balances out some of those
they look at the different districts.
That's right.
That's
right. Mm-hmm. So Representative Dixon was on finance. They wanted to put him on the House as a chair, but they also wanted to make sure District 1 had some representation in finance. And so until I got on finance, there was conversations between leadership. They were making sure that they look at the whole state and try and balance everything out. Mm-hmm. So I think that works well.
So we're down there. The session has started. Governor Little has given his State of the State. What do you see coming up as some of the bigger issues that we'll be looking at this year?
Well, I think we're going to certainly be talking about the initiative process again. That will come back. And then Medicaid expansion. And as part of that, the budget. Don't have the revenues we had a few years ago, and partly due to not quite as much growth, but there's still a lot of growth, and also the tax cut that we gave ourselves. Idaho income tax for most everybody is 7.4%, or was 7.4%. In the session before that I came in, that Idaho income tax was reduced to 6.925, and so that made that. What seems like a small little less than half percentage point difference affects the budget quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. When you talk about the initiative process, that was a big issue going into the end of the session last year. The House and the Senate both passed a more restrictive process to get something on the ballot. The governor vetoed that. Where are we at now as far as can you forecast what it's going to look like when that comes up next?
At the end of the legislative session, anything that's in place, any bills or all of that drops off and we start fresh again. So there's nothing in place right now, but you just have to know, hopefully have the conversations and figure out who might bring something forward. I fully expect that on the initiative process, we will add to it that an initiative, when it's being circulated, has to talk about the cost. It has to be a financial note. Any piece of legislation that is put forth in the legislature has to have a fiscal note that says, here is the expected impact on the budget, because we have a balanced budget requirement through our constitution in the state of Idaho. So I think that you'll see that go right through the legislature, and I think it's appropriate. If we're going to propose something, we have to talk about the cost. Otherwise, you're...
And part of the proposal would be, okay, this is how much it costs. Where's that money going to come from?
Exactly. Yeah. Potential funding source.
So that would have to be on the petition. So when folks are signing just to get something on the ballot, the petition process, there would have to be an explanation of the true cost.
Yes.
And that would, it seems like, have to go through the fiscal entities in Boise.
And so the details are always important. And so who would write that, or estimate a cost? And that might be the Legislative Services Office, or that might be the Division of Financial Management. The Division of Financial Management is in the executive branch under the governor, and they prepare budgets, the governor's budget, and then they bring them to the legislature. And the Legislative Services Office is an office that works for the legislature. We have our three branches of government, and in the Capitol, it's the two of us, the legislative branch and the executive branch. So it might be some mix between the two, but a fiscal note or a report on what the cost, and then a statement of purpose also. So I expect that's the first part of the answer. And then what other potential modifications? Last year, the bill that was vetoed had those two plus a couple more pieces. And we have 35 legislative districts. We used to have 44. We used to have a legislative district in every county, but we have 35 legislative districts based on population. They're sized based on population. And then percentage of voters to approve an initiative. And I'm sure that'll be part of the conversation. I would be speculating at this point.
Well, the trouble it encountered last year was they were raising the bar. They're making it a more restrictive process. And that's where most of the conflict over this change, I think, occurred. Because our it's pretty tough to get an initiative on the ballot right now. They have to, 18 counties? They have to have a certain percentage of signatures come from those counties.
18 of 35 districts.
Districts, excuse me, yes.
And then 6% of registered voters.
Right, right.
And so just even one word in there makes a difference. Is that 6% of registered voters? Or in some states, it's 6% of those who voted in the last election.
All right.
And that can be a big difference.
That'd be a heck of a big difference.
6% of registered. And some states have 10% of those who voted. It's in the details.
Yeah. I heard that in this county, I don't know how many registered voters, but they have to get 1,800 or 1,500 signatures from District 1.
From District 1, right. Yeah, that as a number. If they're trying to hit that threshold in this district. Mm-hmm. I want to swing back around talk about some of the potential initiatives that might come up this year under the current rules. First, maybe talk about a couple other things that might be coming up. Will there be talk about prison or prison financing this year?
I think so. It's all part of that budget picture, and that's why I think it's so important to have the whole picture when you're proposing expenditures, because we have this balance and a struggle going on. We would like to fund education as well as we can and what we can afford. First statement is we have a balanced budget. Now, what are the big pieces of that budget? It was an $8.7 or $8.9 billion budget this year. The big pieces are education, health and welfare, and corrections. Health and welfare and corrections are both growing faster than any other portions of the pie. And so would we prefer to spend money on prisons or would we prefer to spend money on schools?
Schools. And yeah. maybe they won't wind up in prison if they have a good education, right?
The estimates yeah. I've heard are that a dollar in education is equivalent to about 7 to 10 in corrections.
Yeah.
They're the,
yeah.
It costs you 7 to 10 times as
yeah.
much.
Yeah, it costs
afterward.
A lot to house prisoners. Mm-hmm. And do we have a problem right now with having capacity for prisons?
Definitely, yeah. right? I'm on the property tax working group. We were down in Boise a week ago and heard testimony from commissioners and from a sheriff out of Clearwater County and in Ada County, the commissioners, prisoners sleeping on the floor. We're not meeting standards. Of course, there can be a conversation about what standards are appropriate. It shouldn't necessarily be a resort setting, but
a tent maybe. Yeah, that's what some folks go for.
But we are overcrowded, yeah. and we have a problem, and it causes what I understand. It causes a problem with the county is when we don't have a spot in the state prison, then they stay in the county jail. The state reimburses, but is that reimbursement rate adequate for the expenses the county is incurring?
All right. So that's potentially on the going to be a bit of legislation that, or at least talk down there. Another question I had was, so we're coming up on the 2020 census year. So they'll be out taking, the census guys will be out assessing our population, which will inevitably lead to redistricting or adjusting district boundaries at minimum to reflect our population. Is that something that gets dealt with this year, or is that something that might come next year, redistricting?
The census happens in 2020. This is my best understanding right now. 2020 census, and then after the census results, then we'll go into the redistricting process. And that's a six-member commission that is put together by people are nominated or appointed to that by the Speaker of the House and the pro tem of the Senate, the majority party and minority party, kind of losing the details on that one a little bit, but the gist is it's a balanced committee. Okay. So there are typically three Democratic members and three Republican members, and that committee then has the daunting task of redrawing legislative lines. Right now, based on the last census and the last redistricting, the population of each district is approximately 44,000 people. Idaho is growing, will be probably in the range of 50,000 people per district. And so what that means is densely populated areas that they pick up more districts will have, and then the rural areas get bigger. We have District 1, Legislative District 1 encompasses all of Boundary County and most of Bonner County, but just not across on the east side of the Long Bridge and east side of Highway 95. That's District 7. District 7 and 8 are the largest districts. So my counterpart in 7, Senator Crabtree, lives in Grangeville and covers the area from Riggins to Bottle Bay.
Right, all the way up to Sagal. Right,
and he was here last
week. Yeah, he was up here. Oh, well,
yeah,
good.
Yeah.
You know, because we don't have that many people appear that are part that live in that district, so they don't. It feels like they don't get represented as fully because there's such. Over 100 miles, right? I'm sure.
Oh, yeah, it's hundreds of miles from Riggins up back up to here.
Yeah, a couple hundred miles, maybe. Yeah.
And so I expect our district will get a little bit bigger, and there's a good chance.
And that District 7 was something that was pretty new. It was quite different prior to District 7 being created, right?
That's right.
Yeah, so the districts could change dramatically, yeah.
Well, I know the folks in Sagal would like to be part of District 1, so that's kind of probably what they'll be looking at is pulling that up instead of them being part of District 7, disconnected from their legislator, although he did show up last week.
That is my hope, and the guidelines are, I don't know, the rules or guidelines on the process that communities should not be split, and everybody in Bottle Bay and Garfield, Glengarry, those are all part of the Sandpoint community.
Yeah. So, I mean, it makes more sense that you put communities of interest together so that they can have a more cohesive representation down there. But it'll be a problem because our population in the part of the district that you cover has probably grown quite a bit as well. So
Sandpoint has grown.
Some part of Sagal or maybe south of Sagal is going to have to be part of a different district, mm-hmm. almost inevitably.
I just want to remind our listeners, this is 88.5 KRFY. This is the morning show on this Wednesday, November 27th. Chris and Susie were the hosts, and we're here with Senator Jim Woodward for talking about going down to Boise and all things like that. I wanted to re-mention something, and you're talking about the budget, and projecting the budget is probably one of the most difficult things, because I know I read that 88,000 new folks have moved into Idaho. It's the fastest growing state. It could be. I could have read that wrong. But what does that mean when you say, when you're looking at the budget, you're using figures for what we know now. Those 88,000 that moved in last year will be part of the next budget, probably, as far as projection and actual income from, I guess, if they're working here or they live here property, that doesn't affect the state so much, but it's income tax. So how does that work in the projecting looking forward when you know the state's increasing, as you said, in population?
So you do have to try and anticipate that. And from the budgeting perspective, we look at, we have an economist at the state who makes a recommendation. We have the Economic Outlook and Revenue Assessment Committee, which is composed of legislators, and they make a, they sit together and make a recommendation on where they think growth will be. And then the final say on what our budget growth is in the Joint Finance and Appropriations Committee, and we make a call on what we think the growth might be for the year. But the So that happened this year. I watched that happen and saw different opinions on where growth would be, and we overshot a little bit. And so that's affected this process where you see this year the executive branch has had to tell the agencies that we're going to have a 1% rescission, which just means a 1% reduction in the size of your budget. So then during the middle of the year, the agencies are cutting back a little bit. And I believe we're going to have a 2%. When we go through the budgeting process, the base budgets are all going to come down by 2% this coming year. So trying to predict that, and that's on the financial and the accounting type end of it. The other part of it is, how do you appropriately assign costs to growth as people are coming in, the discussion on impact fees, property taxes and new construction. That's a big discussion right now, with assessed values are going up rapidly. And so property taxes, but they really are based on the budget. And so you have, in theory, property taxes don't have to go up if the assessed values are going up, because the millage rate can go down. And we have a law that allows property taxes to go up a maximum of 3%. And then in addition to that, whatever goes on the new construction rolls, that can be above and beyond the 3%. So we do see growth in county budgets everywhere. And that's this big discussion right now, because that changes property taxes. And if you just recently opened your property tax statement, you've seen an increase. So that's hence the reason for the property tax working group. I'm trying to figure out how to balance all that out.
So these increases we're seeing on property taxes are really being driven by this increase in valuations.
They are.
Yeah.
They shouldn't necessarily be from the,
But doesn't that come down to the individual taxing district, like the county, set their budget wherever they want, and that would drive the tax rate down if valuations came up. So, yeah, it's a
complicated situation.
Yeah. It is. And it comes back to that growth, and then what are our expectations for snow plowing and for traffic control and solid waste disposal?
All the services we receive, yeah. We want the services too, so we have to figure out the best way to pay for them.
Yeah.
Where do you want to go with this, Chris? You've got a lot of questions there.
Well, as long as we're talking about financial matters, so last year Reclaim Idaho, a nonprofit organization actually based out of Sandpoint here, ran a ballot initiative to expand Medicaid in Idaho. The initiative passed, and the legislature did execute that law, basically, pretty faithfully, I think. But now there are questions about how it is paid for. The program did allow the most of the program, 90% of it, as I understand, is paid by the federal government as part of the Affordable Care Act. But the state does have to fund about 10% of the new program to expand Medicaid and cover people that were not covered. That was a big discussion last year, how to implement this law. Is that going to come up again this year? And how do you see the legislature dealing with it?
Yes, it will definitely be part of the budget discussion this year. So going back a little bit, traditional Medicaid is a 75% federal funding, 25% state split. And the Medicaid expansion is the 90%, 10%, like you said. So for Medicaid expansion in Idaho, the anticipated number of people signing up was 91,000. We're in the sign-up period right now. And so a month into it, or sort of a little bit less than a month into it, I have about 42,000 signed up was the last number I saw. So if we are at 91,000, the cost for the program is approximately $400 million total. And then, so 10% of that would be funded at the state level. So we budgeted last year for that $40 million number, that 10%. And then because of the budget cycle and the year cycle are 6 months apart, we only had to budget for half of that. So the first year we came up with $20 million in the budget to cover Medicaid expansion from this coming January through July. So that's budgeted. And where that money came from, about half of that, I think, was from the tobacco settlement, which is probably appropriate.
Mm-hmm. There might be some healthcare issues involved there, right? Yeah.
And then looking at some other areas where we should see cost savings. And that's the attempt, is to say, if Medicaid expansion works as hoped, then we have savings in other areas, and then we can use that money to pay for that 10%.
So those savings might come, for instance, from indigent funds around all the counties have to maintain, because people that aren't covered by health insurance, if they show up at a emergency room, the hospital's got to treat them, as I understand.
Yes, there are two funds, one at the state level and one at the county level. Now, the county maintains an indigent fund, and they'll pay up to $11,000 of medical expenses. When the medical expenses go beyond $11,000, then the catastrophic fund is the backup to that at the state level. And so we did, part of that money last year was we should see a reduction in the amount of the catastrophic fund expenditures. And so hopefully both the CAT fund and the indigent fund will slowly become less utilized, and we can transfer that money over. Mm. That's been a little bit of a debate this summer, because there's a working group in the legislature talking about how to pay for Medicaid expansion, and the recommendation from some individuals on that, not from the group as a whole, has been that the county should pick up part of this, and it comes across as a us versus them, and we're all Idahoans, so we just have to figure out where the money comes from. That's my approach to it. If we're using the indigent fund less, then perhaps part of that money can be utilized, but I don't think you'll see the indigent fund go away entirely. And it's oftentimes best to let things play out a little bit, not try and anticipate how everything's going to work, but just maybe it's let the dust settle a little bit, and we'll know where the funds really need to be.
And we have other states that have taken the Medicaid expansion through the federal government program. I think, 35, 37 states, and they kind of have a picture of how it can. I know there's the idea of increased employment because of the need for more medical staffing and things like that. 41,000 people so far enrolled will equate to more need for more medical staff. So we have yet, as you say, yet to see how it will unfold. And you can't anticipate you have to anticipate some things, but you can't anticipate everything, is what it sounds like.
So one question, you mentioned there are about 90,000 that are eligible, mm-hmm. about 41,000 have enrolled so far. Will the legislature have a firm number to work with? Enrollment closes so that we actually know how many people will be on?
Yes, enrollment will close here at the end of December. And then we'll have those numbers to work with.
Yeah, that'll be more instructive then. Yeah.
How does someone enroll?
Yeah, one question.
Go to idaho.gov, right? Idaho, stateidaho.gov or something.
All of the previously, their Idaho Healthcare Exchange, there was the Healthcare Exchange website. So the Healthcare Exchange, Idaho Healthcare Exchange will still continue to exist also, just changes the income range. For the last 8 years or so, or five years, we've had the Idaho Healthcare Exchange, which has been a successful program that's covered folks in the with the income level between 100% to 400% of the federal poverty level. And now that's going to be from 138% to 400%.
So some will fall into the Medicaid expansion
group. That's right. Then that number, I think, is estimated. There are about 15,000 who are currently on the healthcare exchange in that 100 to 138% income level. They have been getting tax credits and they have health programs, health insurance, but they'll go into the Medicaid program.
And those are that 15,000 is probably part of the 41 that has already enrolled, because they probably automatically were enrolled.
I don't know that for sure.
Yeah, we'll see. Yeah, okay, what else do we have, Chris?
Well, Medicaid expansion came as a result of an initiative put forth by Reclaim Idaho, and you mentioned that we're, probably that initiative process is going to come up for some scrutiny at this legislative session. But doing a little research, I saw that there are three potential initiatives that may come forward this year from different citizen groups. You know, initiatives are put together by citizens groups that are passing the petitions around to get the signatures they need to put it on the ballot so people can vote directly on those. One is a minimum wage increase. This would incrementally increase the minimum wage in Idaho to $12 per hour by June of 2024. There's another initiative that's coming forward. It's to create a medical marijuana program in Idaho. And then there's a third one that is being put forward by Reclaim Idaho, and that is to increase the income tax rates on individuals with incomes higher than $250,000 to create a fund for quality education. Do you see any kind of reaction from the legislature on these pending initiatives that might come forward?
Well, on that initiative with the for education, I think part of the basis of that, what the statements that have been made, is that there isn't any action being taken, and I disagree with that statement. In the last 5 years, the total now in the last 5 years, it has been added back into the education budget is $596 million. And I said added back in because we took some significant cuts during the downturn, the Great Recession. And so the argument can be made that we're not where we should be, certainly, but we have a balanced budget, and that's key to our success. Part of the reason we're growing in Idaho is because we have a nice balance between fiscal responsibility, educating our children, taking care of those who are in need. And so adding $596 million, which there'll be an adjustment at the end of the year, and we'll end up over $600 million in the last 5 years. And so that's a pretty substantial investment in our system. And I can tell you that both Governor Little and many members of the legislature, the majority of the legislature, want to have a great educational system in the state of Idaho, a solid educational system that provides a foundation for the people in Idaho to go forward. And so the other side of that is that initiative is it's asking people to authorize a tax increase, and that's typically not
successful in the legislature.
Not successful with members of the state of Idaho.
Yeah. So you know, they are specifying this would be an increase on individuals with higher incomes above mm-hmm. $250,000 and increases in corporate income tax rate.
Mm-hmm.
The legislature isn't likely to look at this, hey, they got an initiative hanging out there, maybe we should do something along those lines before the initiative comes to bear.
Well, we already have a budget request So the budgeting process and starts in the summer. The budget development manual is put out, and then from that, the agencies develop the requests. And the superintendent of schools has already developed a budget with another addition, $100 million in requests this year. And we know that with the education task force that was that operated all summer, that our my predecessor Sean Keogh was on, and run by the board. State Board of Education President Debbie Critchfield, the recommendations coming out of that task force show how we value education. And so there's a lot in place. And I don't know that is necessary at this point, is my thought. Because in my view, I value the initiative process. You saw that I voted against those changes last year because I thought those were too significant of changes. But I think the initiative process is a backup to the legislative process. We have a process in place that we're paying for, a capital, 105 members, staff, and there is a process to go and provide your input there. I said that it sometimes feels pretty remote for us because we're as far away from the capital as you can get, but that's improving, and if you want to propose a program, a piece of legislation is as simple as finding a legislator and saying, this is what I like to do, and get some buy-in, and here's why. I'm talking with a group at the Sandpoint Middle School next week, and they'd like to see, the students would like to see defibrillators in all the schools. And so the way that could happen is through a piece of legislation.
Those students want to take care of their teachers, I guess.
Well, if that's nothing else, the ballot petition, the ballot initiative process does create conversation. And just hearing your perspective on Reclaim Idaho's Invest in Idaho, you know, how it's overlapping with some of the stuff that's actually going on in Boise right now is very interesting. So I appreciate that conversation.
So to dig in just one, a little bit more on this particular question of funding education. You know, the Lake Pottery School District just went through a big discussion about making the current supplemental levy permanent. And as I understand it, there are, I think, 95 out of 115, roughly, school districts in Idaho now are relying on supplemental levies to adequately fund their school districts. And the complaint is that that kind of funding is falling strictly on property tax payers. And so is there a way to one thing about this initiative is that it would put it more onto income tax of, you know, wealthier individuals. And I do know that the state of Idaho, its budget is the biggest chunk of it is by far education. So it's not like Idaho is not trying to fund education. It's just that it doesn't feel like the pot is big enough. Do you see a funding solution that would help provide some tax relief for property taxpayers on this question?
I always like to step back to 2006, because that's where this discussion started. We changed from having an M&O property tax line item, a school M&O property tax line item on our property tax statements, because of rising values and a strong economy in 2006, like we're in now, property taxes were escalating. And the answer that came forth at that time was to get rid of the M&O property tax line item, but increase our sales tax from 5% to 6%. And so that was a shift in how we tax, that going from property tax to income tax.
There's a sales tax as well, right? Wasn't there an increase in sales tax?
We went from 5% to 6% on sales tax. Yeah. And so the numbers that I know, that was about a $210 million increase in sales tax revenue at the time. But we took away about $250 million. So it was about a $40 million shortfall at the time. But it's also driven this conversation and caused this situation where so many districts have had to add into their budgets with a local supplemental levy.
Do you see a way for that to change, or is that, do you think that'll be the funding formula that we pretty much stick with for the foreseeable future?
Well, the funding formula is another big topic for the legislature this year. Nothing changed last year except for our little definitions bill. But it's that balance. We're trying to find a balance between people just talk about taxation as the three-legged stool between income tax, sales tax, and property tax, and what is the appropriate balance, because who do you affect on those? And education is a system that we all participate in at some point. And then income tax and sales tax, or two that go to the general fund, are something that we all participate in. Sales tax especially, we all pay into sales tax. So maybe that was appropriate, but maybe not. In hindsight, it caused this tough situation we're in now. I don't have a clear-cut answer for you, Chris.
Well, get down there and
just start studying, huh?
Figure that out.
We are just about out of time, however, and I just wanted to throw out one thing about Reclaim Idaho's ballot petition drive that they're doing right now. It's called Invest in Idaho. The one thing that struck me is that where the funding would go if this went through and there was this pile of money, this fund for education, it would not go to administrative costs. And I thought that, you know, is a little bit different than general budget, but just to throw that out. We want to thank you, Jim Woodward, Senator Woodward, for coming in today. And how are you feeling about going back to Boise and being down there?
I think I'm much more prepared than last year. I know a lot more people and understand. It'll be easier to anticipate what I need to be prepared for. Mm-hmm. So the one thing on tax policy that I'd add to that, last year there was a court decision called the Wayfair decision, that company, the online catalog retailer Wayfair, and it said that we're going to collect sales tax. So we now collect sales tax on internet sales for companies doing more than $100,000 worth of business, I believe. Oh. Well, that pot, last I heard, was already up to $22 million. And for some, I don't quite understand why we set that aside for tax relief. It's sales tax just like any other. So in my mind, we should have just put it right into the sales tax revenue. Maybe we'll work toward that. But there's another source of income now to the state in internet sales. And that's a source of revenue from our pockets, but we're paying that online sales tax now. And so getting that in the right spot where we can use it for education is, I think, appropriate.
Well, there you go. I noticed my Amazon bill has sales tax on it now.
Yes.
Yeah. And so. A lot of them do now. You know, it's kind of unpleasant to hit the tax at the end of the checkout. On the other hand, retailers here have been at an unfair disadvantage because they have to charge sales tax for their brick and mortar store. Yeah. And yet these online retailers basically get to offer that up for free. So that's a correction in that sense. Let me ask one more quick question here. You mentioned, you know, getting back there after your first year. There was a story by Betsy Russell in the Idaho State Journal recently on a study by Boise State University that found that civility has declined in the Idaho legislature. Now, of course, you don't have much to compare it to, but how did you find working with your colleagues down there?
That has been my joke this summer, and people ask me, it was so contentious. How did you deal with that? And I said, well, that's my normal. That's what I think of as the legislature. Apparently it has changed a little bit, I've not lost hope, and I think it's simply about talking to people. We kind of get this idea that everything has to be divisive, and we can have conversations and disagree. Because anytime you get into a one-on-one conversation with somebody, you find something in common.
Mm-hmm. Right. And the whole act of debating out an issue from different sides helps us arrive at better decisions, I think.
Yeah. It is exactly the process. Yeah. That's right, yeah. Chris. It was intended to be a little bit of a push and pull.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Senator Woodward, again for coming in. And citizens that want to be involved, informed, and can make a difference can get a hold of you. You're our legislator. You're our senator. And we appreciate your transparency and involvement in our lives that way and serving. So is there a contact for not maybe you so much, but what is that website again?
The website is legislature.idaho.gov. And when it comes up, you can click on Senator House, and then you can find the members of the Senate, and you'll find my email address, jwoodward at senate.idaho.gov. You can find the other members also. And sometimes, for example, if you see a committee that and you're concerned about an issue, look at all those committee members and send all of them an email, not just your own. It happens. I got an email yesterday, or I get letters and emails from people from around the state who know that I'm on the education committee, and so they have a concern and share their thoughts.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. Well, best of luck. I don't know if luck is the right word, but I hope the time down there is fruitful for you and for all of us up here. And again, thank you. This is 88.5 KRFY. We're just about out of time. We have a few announcements to make. Tomorrow on the morning show, we have, yes, it is Thanksgiving, and we want to say happy Thanksgiving to everyone. But Jim and Jack will actually be here, and they will be playing some special songs that deal with things, people, and concepts that we should all be thankful for. I'm curious of what those are. I'm sure they'll come up with some great songs for us. And also, everyone's invited to our annual meeting. Put it on your calendar, December 18th from 5 to 8 at the Idaho Poor Authority. So it's not just a meeting. It's a fun fundraiser for KRFY, your community radio station. And we're reaching out to our listeners at this point in time to say we are listener supported. We're commercial free. We're community radio. So you can go to our website, krfy.org, and make a end of the year donation. That's what we're looking for to meet our budget. So thank you. And we're going to go out with a song. Anything you want to say, Chris, before we hit the Beatles?
No, just have a happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving. This is the Beatles, Can't Buy Me Love, as from Senator Woodward, his song, his choice. Have a great day. Thank you.